From the wet heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, weird things happening, people acting strange. Why? Could it be Mercury retrograde? We'll talk about that. But here's what's happening. Tensions with Iran remain high as mystery is swirling around the whereabouts of the status of an oil tanker in the Persian Gulf. U.S. officials believe Iran has seized the small coastal tanker along with its crew of 25 people. We'll find out what happens there. The United States said that it was removing Turkey from the F-35 fighter jet program, a move that had been long threatened and expected after Turkey began accepting delivery of an advanced Russian missile defense system last week. Things are getting tense there. Turkey used to be a great NATO ally. I don't know if that's going to happen anymore. A U.S. judge has sentenced Mexican drug kingpin El Chapo Guzman to life in prison plus 30 years. Guzman, 62 years old, was found guilty of 10 charges, including drug trafficking and money laundering, by a federal court back a few months ago. Newly released federal data shows that drug makers and distributors increased shipments of opioid painkillers across the U.S. as the nation's addiction crisis accelerated from 2006 to 2012. The data released this week by a federal court in Ohio as part of a far-reaching opioids case shows that companies distributed 8.4 billion pills to commercial pharmacies in 2006 and 12.6 billion in 2012. That's an increase of over 50%, and I got to tell you, it's probably much higher now. Howard Bloom, of course, the author of The Genius of the Beast, is with us. Howard, that's outrageous, isn't it?
Well, this is a big story. Thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, the Washington Post was able to get its hands on those 7 years of secret data from the Drug Enforcement Administration on the growth of the opioid crisis, as you said, from 2006 to 2012, and the results were absolutely startling. In that seven-year period, 2006 to 2012, 76 billion opioid pills were distributed. That's 76 billion with a B. Only 3% of those pills came from Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the company being blamed for the opioid crisis. 90% came from three generic drug companies, SpecGX, Par Pharmaceutical, and Activist Pharma. During that 7 year period, opioids were implicated in 100,000 deaths. That's 23 times more than the entire toll of American lives in the Iraq War. The result is now that 2,000 state, local, and tribal entities are suing drug companies. But drug companies, these lawsuits claim caused the opioid epidemic. But in reality, it's a lot more complicated. Pain caused the opioid epidemic, and nature is to blame for pain. Look, 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain, the kind of nonstop pain that tortures you every day and every month, the sort of pain that is sometimes more than you can endure. But here's the problem. Until the 1990s, 20th century doctors ignored pain. Then the medical profession woke up to a simple fact. Patients, you and me, come to them because of pain. In fact, we come hoping that doctors could get rid of our pain. Yet medical students got only 11 hours of pain training in their years of education. Veterinarians, on the other hand, got 40 hours of pain training. Meanwhile, there was a new class of miracle painkillers. Slow-release opioids, drugs like oxycodone and hydrocodone, opioids you only had to take once every 12 hours. Now, the Food and Drug Administration reasoned that because these drugs were designed for slow release into the bloodstream, they wouldn't produce a high and wouldn't be used for recreational purposes. So the FDA regarded the new slow-release opioids as low risk. What's more, insurance companies were in love with the new painkillers. Insurance companies and the entire American medical system push doctors to get you in and out of their office as quickly as possible so your doc can process more than 20 patients a day, preferably with almost no return visits. Writing a prescription for the new slow-release opioids was fast and it was final, but the problem was just beginning. In the 7 years from 2006 to 2012, doctors prescribed enough opioid pills to give every man, woman, and child in America a four-month supply.
Jeez.
And 4 months is addictive, but that's not all. 8% of the folks who start on the opioids prescribed by their doctors become addicted to them, which helps explain why opioid overdose deaths were 32,000 in 2018. But that number is uncomfortably close to the 40,000 deaths from guns and the 36,750 deaths from automobiles. So what do we do about this? If you have a constant pain that you can't escape, get your MD to refer you to a pain doctor or a pain clinic. Stanford University's pain specialist Sean Mackey claims there are 200 non-opioid painkillers, including marijuana. Only a pain doctor is going to know all of these. When I was attacked a year ago by 6 months of severe stomach pains, I used CBD oil to make the pain bearable, but just making the pain go away is not enough. Let your doctor figure out what's causing your agony.
That's right.
Turns out that my pain came from two giant kidney stones, and surgery was the ultimate answer. Without the surgery, those kidney stones were about to kill one of my kidneys. Meanwhile, try very hard to steer clear of opioids and keep any opioids your doctor may give you away from teenagers.
Howard's website is his name, Howard Bloom, BLOOM.net. Thank you, Howard. Good report. Have you ever used a oven cleaner spray? Well, you know, number one, you can't breathe that stuff in. And then you just watch how it kind of eats away at all the gook in your oven. Well, a company behind a potent oven cleaning product said it's investigating after a 25-year-old woman in England claimed that a small drop ate away at the flesh on her arm, leaving her permanently scarred. It's almost like acid. Be careful. Chimpanzees enjoy watching movies together and get a sense of closeness and bonding through shared experience, according to scientists. A study of apes watching videos suggests that human social bonding may have deeper evolutionary roots than previously thought. Story that we reported yesterday, it doesn't take a scientific study to know that spending some time with a cuddly cat or friendly dog will probably put you in a better mood. That being said, though, researchers from Washington State University have found objective psychological evidence that just 10 minutes spending petting a dog or a cat will lower stress levels. That's amazing. So I thought we'd check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, we always knew this. I know you always knew this. This is amazing.
Well, I mean, I found it a little surprising that they could actually set up a test that would show a change in cortisol levels the
yeah.
next morning, if it's real, which it very well may be, that 10 minutes with a pet will improve your day enough so that you have less stress and therefore less of the stress response. The thing that's, there's so many things so interesting about the genres. First of all, the need for humans to have companionship. It goes way before even chimpanzees. It goes back to our being mammals. Mammals have babies that mm-hmm. then cling to them and nurse from them. So we go back to a strain of creature that begins with love and touching and nursing, and it's key to our lives. I wish that these studies, like the one you were citing, you know, just didn't limit themselves to this idea of interaction. You know, what they say, George, is 10 minutes of interaction with an animal. Too many of our scientists are still afraid to talk about love. They're afraid to say, dogs love us. We love dogs. Dogs trust us. We trust dogs. That they're these wonderful things that are spiritual, fundamentally, emotional, that take place between us. It's not just interaction with the dog. And if they start looking at that, they're going to realize that human beings need not just interaction with each other, but kindness and love and trust, at least on the level that we can have it with our dogs.
Good point.
We need to be more like dogs, George.
And cats. Peter, thank you so much. Dr. Peter Breggin, great guy. Up next, we're going to be talking with Stephen Cohen. He was with me a couple weeks ago as we were talking about U.S.-Russian relations, and we had such an amazing pouring in of phone calls and questions and emails. I thought we'd do part two with Stephen, and we will. And his latest book is called War with Russia. We'll talk about all this, and next hour we'll take your phone calls with Stephen Cohen, and we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Very important couple hours here with Stephen Cohen. Stephen Cohen is a professor of Russian studies and history emeritus at NYU and professor of politics emeritus at Princeton University. He is among the most distinguished scholars of Russian history in the United States, internationally recognized for his academic works on Russia and Soviet political history since 1917. Professor Cohen is also an expert on Russian-American relations and has for decades contributed both domestically and abroad in shedding light on the two countries and the political and historical relationship. We are proud that he is a regular guest here on Coast to Coast, and his latest book is called War with Russia, From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. And welcome back, Stephen Cohen. What an outcry we had. We had to get you back again, Stephen.
What were they crying out about? Protesting or?
No, we want Cohen. We want Cohen.
Really, really. I don't know, George, whom you're reaching in this country. I was thinking, though, about what you just said, that I was a Russia expert. I have put in a lot of years of work, and I got all the academic degrees. But it appears from the media that everybody's a Russia expert today. That's one of the things that Russiagate.
That's a problem.
All these generalizations about Russian behavior and Putin and the nature of Russia on the part of people that, so far as I know, never studied Russia, don't know the language, never been there, and never were interested in Russia until this became politically profitable or at least enticing. So for a person such as myself, it's a troubling time.
It sure is. And before we get into what we have at hand here with you, Stephen, I got to get your reaction to what's going on with Turkey now. Once one of our great allies in NATO, you know, we used to have missiles in Turkey. That's what caused the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 62. Now it appears that Turkey is switching its allegiance to Russia. That's just my gut feeling. But what do you think?
Well, let me begin with a kind of professorial abstraction that I hope won't scare away our listeners. But we, all of us, are living in a time of profound international change. The world that you and I grew up in, with its order partly structured by the existence of the Soviet Union, people forget that whatever the minuses of the Soviet Union, its existence created a kind of stable international structure. There was the American bloc and the Soviet bloc, and we competed in what was called the Third World, Africa, and all that. But generally, as bad as things were sometimes during that Soviet-American Cold War, there was also a lot of stability. And that's gone today. Everywhere we look, the world is changing. Countries that were thought to be our allies, and after all, I think you mentioned that Turkey is a member of NATO, and NATO is, of course, the American military-led alliance. What does this mean, that a NATO country is buying weapons from Russia and defying the President of the United States? Well, I think what it means is that everything's in flux.
Everything.
The Chinese, isn't there a Chinese saying, I can't remember, may you live in interesting times? I'm not sure what interesting means, but the turmoil. And of course, for a person such as myself, who spent his life studying Russia, I always hope that Russia's in the news, but I never wanted it to be in the news the way it is today in Washington with Russiagate and the rest. And of course, the Russians themselves are reacting very profoundly to what's going on in Washington, and in ways that, you know, I have a lot of Russian friends of several generations, in a ways that are not flattering to America.
How could we let these things happen with Turkey, though, for example? And that's just one example. How can we let that slip away? This is horrible detente. Horrible.
So let me give you my theory. And people who professionally study international relations, I can't say I do, but there are a lot of people. I don't know if you know John Mersheimer, for example.
I do not, no.
At the University of Chicago. I think he's probably our leading theorist and student. He's a former Marine, I believe. He's a tough guy. He's a scholarly guy. He's a good talker. You should talk to him sometime.
Okay.
Those people study international relations as a discipline. I mean, they have their theories, they have their history. For a person such as myself who sees the world through American and Russian eyes primarily, what's striking is the way all our assumptions about how countries would react and with whom they would ally are changing. And I ask myself, what's at the bottom of this? And I think it's captured by the word sovereignty. Every country now wants to be sovereign, independent of the influence and power of great powers. So what that translates into is the kind of nationalism that we sometimes deplore in the United States, right?
Yes.
And what's new is, and maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, we sometimes, you and I, George, sometimes speak generationally, because the younger people may not remember this, but I don't recall in my lifetime people talking about American nationalism. We didn't use that word. We used the word patriotism.
Right.
Other countries had nationalism. We had patriotism. But, of course, we were always American nationalists. I mean, Trump's slogan, America First, is an old slogan. I mean, he didn't invent it. And in some ways, every American president promised that he'd keep America first, the number one superpower. But what's happening now is every country wants to be sovereign. Partly this is because a kind of delayed reaction to the end of the Soviet Union, which controlled so many countries. They had lost their sovereignty to the Soviet Union. But also it's the diminishing of American power. If we're honest, America controlled or strongly influenced the behavior of a lot of governments around the world, large and small. So as the two, what we used to call the superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States, either disappear or are diminished, all these countries now want to be sovereign. And I think that's what you see in Turkey. There are political forces in Turkey that want to be independent of great powers. They want to buy the weapons that they think are best for them, whether they're Russian or American. They don't feel obliged to buy American weapons anymore, even though, and this is the what shocks some people, Turkey is a member of NATO.
Yeah.
Now, let's be honest. I mean, you don't have to be a Marxist to understand that NATO is very good business for American weapon makers, because it's required of member nations of NATO to buy standardized military equipment. And most of that equipment, not all of it, but most of it, is built by American weapons manufacturers.
That's right.
So NATO is a terrific market. But if you get a country such as Turkey, a NATO country, buying weapons from Russia, either because they're better, cheaper, or they just want to show they're independent, this has an economic consequence. So you're getting a lot of grumbling in Washington.
Well, and what are they buying the weapons for? They're not going to use them against Russia, or Russia wouldn't have sold it to them in the first place. I mean, it's strange, isn't it?
You've asked a question above my pay grade. Why do so many countries overarm? I mean, why do we have 800 military bases around the world?
Yeah.
Why do we spend, what's the new military budget? It just went up under Trump. Is it $700 billion?
It is huge.
And by the huge. Way, that's the official budget. The real budget would include all sorts of military expenditures that are attached to the budget, for example, of the CIA.
And those numbers we don't know. I mean, as a matter of fact, Catherine Austin Fitz, one of our expert guests, said there's $21 trillion unaccounted for. $21 trillion unaccounted for.
You mean military allocated to military?
We don't know. Nobody knows where it went or what it was used for or where it is.
So it's a kind of black budget.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, what's her guess where it went?
She doesn't know. She just can't speculate on that. All she knows is it appears that $21 trillion is missing from our coffers.
And does anyone in Congress raise this question?
No. No.
Huh.
No, it's the same with what we're going to talk about in a second, and that is Russia and Iran's relationship. Nobody seems to notice what's going on there.
Well, I don't think that's entirely accurate, because there's a lot of consternation in NATO and in Washington.
Well, I mean in terms of media people.
Oh, media people. If we go into a discussion of what American media covers, I would guess, though there's only two or three countries whose media I cover, so maybe I shouldn't generalize, but we're really provincial in terms of our media. Both the extent and quality of our international coverage in the United States is far below that of other countries.
Well, that's true. Stephen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk specifically about Russia and Iran and what we're going to be doing about this situation and some other issues. Stephen Cohen with us. His latest book is called War with Russia. We'll tell you how you can get this book. If you want to know about world affairs, he's the guy to read. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Stephen Cohen with us. We'll take calls with Stephen next hour. His latest book is called War with Russia. Stephen, when can we get the book? Is it available now?
Amply available. It's been out 2 or 3 months. It's in paperback. It's relatively inexpensive. And it covers the period that you and I have been discussing, the period just before Trump became president to the present, and the what I call the new Cold War, which I've argued on your broadcast and in the book, is more dangerous than the Cold War we survived.
Indeed. Now, last month, the president met with Vladimir Putin. They had a quiet sit-down meeting in Japan. We really don't know or haven't heard much about what was discussed in that meeting. But here's one of the situations that I'm really concerned about. This Iranian situation, Stephen, is getting more and more tense. I mean, now they apparently took some kind of United Arab Emirate tanker with 20-some men aboard. Something's going on, and unless it's another Gulf of Tonkin episode, and I don't think it is this time. If we get involved militarily with Iran, what's Russia going to do about that? Because they have an allegiance with them.
I have been asking myself that question the last month or so as Trump's polemics against Iran have increased. So Russia, this is the last thing Russia would want. Let's try to see the world through Russia's eyes. Iran is immensely important to Russia. It's a very large Islamic country on Russia's borders. Russia, as I pointed out on your broadcast before, has about, I think, 17 million Islamic citizens of its own in the Russian Federation. There are about 145 million Russian citizens, and about 17 million of them are declared believing Muslims. So, to a certain extent, Russia is an Islamic country as well, and it can't afford, it doesn't want, it will do anything to avoid being dragged into any kind of civilization war with the Islamic world. And yet there it is, right in the crosshairs, right on the borders of East and West. So to the extent that Putin prays, he prays that there won't be an American-Iranian war. But undoubtedly, he and his advisors regularly discuss the what if. If it comes to that, what will Russia do? It would like to stay out of it, but it's not clear that it's possible. It's a major weapons provider to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It has a political diplomatic alliance with Iran, which emerged during the Syrian war. Interestingly, though it's not noted in the United States, Russia has pursued a foreign policy under Putin which is described as, we won't have good relations with anyone who wants good relations with us. In other words, this is the opposite of the old Soviet attitude toward foreign policies, which was highly ideological, right? They wanted to have the closest relations with people who shared or had a kinship for their communist or socialist ideology. Putin is pursuing a kind of ecumenical or agnostic foreign policy. So what's interesting is that Russia has excellent relations, for example, now with Israel. Partly that's because there are so many former Soviet citizens, Russian Jews,
Huge.
Who now live in Israel.
As a matter of fact, I was doing my Beyond Belief television taping last week in Denver. One of my guests was talking about an upcoming show on mummies and that were discovered in Peru. And he's a Russian Jewish individual. He's a professor. He still lives in St. Petersburg, but he is a Russian Jew, and he loves it. I mean, to him, he's more Russian than Israeli, but he is Jewish.
So here, to go back to my original point, that we are living when the whole world is changing, that the alliances and the blocs and the affinities and the kind of associations that we took for granted when we grew up are changing. So we grew up And I say we, though, even though I'm Jewish, I didn't have come from a household that was observant or actually paid. I've never been to Israel. I don't boast on that. It just, I travel to Russia when I'm able, when I have the money and the time to travel. But my family didn't have a close affinity for Israel. But nonetheless, during my childhood, it was always assumed that Israel was ours, America's, and that it had no affinity with Russia. And yet today, relations between Russia and Israel are exceedingly good. And moreover, relations between Putin and the leadership of Israel, the prime minister and the foreign minister, are very, very, very good.
Well, would that stay the same way if Israel ends up attacking Iran?
Well, again, we come back to your point, which is what's troubled me for weeks, and I can't answer the question, but I do know that this is at the top of the worry list in the Kremlin. What will it do if Israel and maybe the United States attack Iran? Of course, it would be a really bad idea if they did that, because if we thought the Syrian war destabilized the Middle East or the war in tiny Yemen is destabilizing, imagine what a war with Iran would be. It is a very large, great power country.
What if it was a very strategic pinpoint attack, Stephen, where they just took out known nuke sites, or where they're doing all that work for uranium enrichment, and they just took out those areas?
So I'm thinking about that as you ask the question. And I don't rule that out. And
I mean, there would be some collateral damage, and there would be some lives lost of the people who are working there, but it's not as extensive as bombing Tehran, for example.
So let's just say that you hadn't asked me that question, but President Trump had.
All right.
So he would say, so, Cohen, we're going to do this very strategic strike on Iran, and we want to do it in a way that doesn't bring Russia into the war, right? What do we do? Well, technically, of course, you can do what you, George, said. You could hit strategic targets. You could try not to kill many and possibly any people. I mean, they know how to do this, right? They know shifts. They know when people are in buildings and all the rest. The problem is and we don't pay any attention to this in the United States, because we always say, well, Putin's a dictator, an autocrat, and Russian politics and policy is what Putin says it is. But that's not the case. Putin has his own politics. He has conflicting interest groups and ideology swirling around him, tugging at both sleeves. Boss, boss, we got to do this. And on his other hand, they're saying, boss, boss, well, you dare not do that. So, to Iran, there would be enormous pressure on Putin to intervene on the side of Iran in one way or another.
Well, what does Putin do once we've taken out those areas? We didn't bomb the cities. We didn't do anything. It's not war. We're not trying to occupy Iran. But if we just take out those sites after the fact, what does he do? Does he try to attack the United States or Israel? What?
No, he would never do that, of course. So here we enter into a kind of technical question. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of this anti-aircraft defense system that the Russians possess. It used to be called the SS-300, and now it's been upgraded, and it's called the SS-400. Have you heard about this?
With some supersonic weaponry?
It has, purportedly, and I mean according to Russian test and Russian defense ministry, it has the capacity to impose essentially a no-fly zone over an area between 250 and 400 miles. That is, it could pretty much, when Russia gives this system to a country, shoot down an incoming aircraft or missiles over a large part of the country. It's considered a kind of protective shield. And Russia has given junior variants of the system. It's extreme. Russia's reluctant to give any country, even a close friend country, the full system, because the country could learn how to make it itself once it had it.
Might they have given it a part of it to Iran when they took down our drone?
They have given elements of it to Iran. They've given elements of it to China. They've deployed elements of it to protect Assad in Syria. But here's the problem for Russia. I mean, let's look at it through Russian eyes. It would be a very long time it would take to train technicians in that country to operate the system. So therefore, Russians would have to do it, at least for the first year or two.
Here's my theory.
And let me just make my final point.
All right.
Any retaliation by the United States or Israel would have some probability of killing Russians. And that's where the red line is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't want to do that. Yeah. I agree. This is what I think could happen. Seriously happen. We will do strategic targeting of Iran to hit their uranium enrichment areas. And the moment we do that, Russia's retaliation will be not us, not Israel. They go into Ukraine because they figure we're not going to stop them because they haven't stopped us. What do you think?
Well, I think, again, if you stick with my model that Putin has advisors who give him conflicting advice, and by the way, I know fairly well one advisor, and I know his thinking, and I've met on two occasions another senior advisor, and I know his thinking, and they don't agree. So Putin gets conflicting advice. I mean,
so does President Trump.
So it is. Well, it's the nature of leadership, to be realistic.
Sure. I mean,
a leader, no matter how much power the leader has, can't know to the degree needed about everything.
No, that's why he's got his advisors.
And that's why we used to have a saying in this country. Do you remember it? Judge a president by the people around him.
Yep.
You remember that?
Yep.
And it's not an unwise thing. And that's why when I look at the presidential candidates today, I say, who's advising this candidate on the subjects that I care most
exactly
about?
I don't think they have anybody behind them yet. You know, I mean, if I were running for president, I would assemble my staff immediately before I even announced and have people like you on my staff.
Well, one of the complaints against President Obama when he was elected is he didn't really have a team. He had sort of come out of nowhere. And so what he did in the first term was staff essential positions with former Clinton people. And it created a tension within the administration. And that's never a good idea. A guy like Bernie Sanders, I don't think he's ever going to be president, but this is his second run, so he did build something of a team his first time out.
Yeah, he's fading, but you're right.
But I mean, when we talk about who has, I mean, I ask myself when I look at the candidates that seem to be plausible to me, when I look beyond the candidate as a personality, what they say and what I think their capacity to learn is and ask questions and understand alternative choices and make the right choice, I ask who's advising them. And sometimes we know and sometimes we don't. And sometimes it's alarming to me who they brought next to them, and sometimes I'm encouraged.
Well, what do you think, though, about my speculation that if we go into Iran, Putin goes into Ukraine?
So, I you asked a really good question, and my mind drifted, and I didn't focus on it. So, this has been discussed to the nth degree in the Kremlin, what to do if push comes to shove in Ukraine. And there is, and we've heard them, and they have their own newspapers, so we can read. I mean, there's a great freedom of the press in Russia, and there's a lot of controversy in the Russian media. People don't know this in this country. On television, there are talk shows like yours, George, on radio and on television, where people with opposing views who are close to the Kremlin come on and give their opposing views. So we know to a certain extent the range of views.
And they don't disappear the next day?
No, I mean, Russia's changed.
It's not interesting.
It's not like the old censored. There's no historical censorship in Russia any longer. I'm a historian. I work in the archives. I read the journals. I know the historians. There may be some self-censorship where people just don't want to go to a certain topic, but that exists in all countries. Some historians don't want to write about something because it'll make people angry at them.
Sure. Well, back to Ukraine, though.
All right. So back to Ukraine. It's been discussed at great length. To what extent can Russia actually occupy Ukraine? The pluses are that a very large part of the Ukrainian people are not only ethnic Russians, but native Russian speakers, mm-hmm. native Russian speakers, and or highly sympathetic to Moscow, not to Kiev. So there would be people in Ukraine as the Russian army moves from the border with Russia deeper towards central Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Western Ukraine is impossible. I mean, it's a separate part of Ukraine that is very close to sort of Polish thinking, let's say. It's not representative of Ukraine. It's where the really intense Ukrainian national, anti-Russian nationalism is. But it's a relatively small part of Ukraine. And it has a lot of neo-fascists there who are ready to fight and are armed and are a problem for the government. But if Russia were to occupy Ukraine, that is, send troops in, and leave aside bombing, but paratroopers descend behind the lines, the whole rigmarole, right? The general view in Moscow is it would be a disaster.
It may be, but we're not going to do anything about it.
Well, there we come to President Trump, don't we?
Yep.
We, as the President of the United States, who can, even though the Constitution says he can't, make war on his own, and presidents have, correct? We've been in a lot of wars that Congress never voted on or authorized. So you have Trump, who's accused of being somehow pro-Kremlin or pro-Putin, which is complete nonsense, would be under tremendous pressure to react and maybe overreact. So I would consider that to be an exceedingly dangerous situation. But I think it would be a disaster for Russia to invade or move deeper, more deeply into Ukraine.
Interesting.
I mean, look, for example, we don't pay much attention to it, and I was there, and I'm kind of fascinated by it, Crimea. So to remind your listeners, Crimea is this peninsula that has passed between Russia and Ukraine for centuries. And its people, the Crimean people, I think are about, don't hold me to this, I'd have to look it up, but about 75% either ethnic or native-speaking Russians. A very large number of the minority are Ukrainian. And then there are the ethnic Tatar Crimeans and indigenous Tatar people who claim as their homeland Crimea. So it's a polyglot region. It's absolutely beautiful, George. I mean, I went there for the first time 2 years ago, and I spent about a week in two Crimean cities, including Yalta, which is famous because that's where Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin met during World War II.
Yes, exactly.
But it's utterly magnificent. I mean, geographically, it's surrounded by the Black Sea. It has mountains. The climate is wonderful. The water, I like oceans without high waves and relatively warm. It's just absolutely beautiful. And it has centuries and centuries and centuries of history, in the form of ruins of almost every seafaring ancient nation came to Crimea for its grapes. Crimea makes fabulous world wines. They're not known in the United States very well, but they're very popular.
Hold on, Stephen. We'll pick that up when we come back. Plus, we'll take phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.